Morning Edition and Morning News with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you in part by Park City Medical Center, Jans Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, Promontory The Ranch Club, and Promontory Foundation, and Carl Malone Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram.
KPCW News Time now, 8:17. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. The Park City Board of Education meeting for the first time this year at a work session yesterday in the studio with me to take a look at what was discussed. I have school board members Nancy Garrison and Julie Eihausen. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So the board spent some time yesterday on community engagement, part of that moving forward from November's failed bond. You took a survey of staff members apparently before the holidays, specifically asking about moving the ninth graders back into the high school. Reportedly, there was overwhelming support for that, 90%. But in fact, as I, follow this issue along, that was really never an issue as to whether or not we should move the ninth grade back. It seems like there was always support for that. Where we kind of came down to rubber meeting the road was where we build the extension onto the high school. So what did you learn from this survey?
Well, I think, Leslie, our focus is continually on what's academically best for our kids. And it's really important to check in with our educators to understand what their beliefs are about the curricular and academic needs and whether or not having all four grades in the high school is what they perceive as being in the best interest of students. And in fact, as you just mentioned, 90% of our faculty believe that to be the case. It's not in their purview necessarily to determine where those classrooms will go, but it is important that we understand and that they have buy-in that it is what's best for kids. You know, we took a look at also yesterday at SAGE data, and Park City High School is top in our state in terms of academic performance, so we must continue to focus on what's best for kids and making sure that our faculty is engaged in that conversation.
Let me get back to that SAGE data then. So what did the 10% say?
A variety of comments that included matters of social, are ninth graders mature enough to be in the same vicinity with 11th and 12th graders? That's the same matter that exists with kindergartens and fifth graders. It's something that our educators are uniquely skilled in managing, and they clearly don't perceive a problem with it.
Mm-hmm. And so the staff members, the majority of them wanting ninth grade, saying it's just better academically. I mean, was that the reason for doing that?
Well, academically and then also socially. It also is much better for the ninth graders to actually understand that they are in high school, that this is on their transcript, that this is, the beginning of the very serious portion of their education. And for them to move forward, they do need to do well in ninth grade. And having them in the building with that, with the peer group that is all moving on and looking forward to college, it's just very important.
Yeah. Again, but that's really not a whole lot of new information. I mean, I think what we need answers to is how do we expand the high school if, in fact, we're moving it back? So where do we go from here with that?
I think that's the work that's ahead of us. I think we're looking at a longer time frame than, unfortunately, we had hoped had the bond passed. And we're exploring the options of what to do in an interim situation. Does that mean that we have portable learning facilities? Does it mean that Treasure Mountain stays up longer than it should because part of the end of the year work that we did was reviewing once again all the construction and facilities reports that indicate that building is beyond its useful life.
Yeah, so if we are moving forward with grade realignment, 2017 to 18 school year, mm-hmm. we've got to have a place for the ninth graders. I mean, is that what mm-hmm. we need to start looking at then? Let's just say, okay, we don't have the bond money. Let's just look at where we're going to put the portable classrooms. Is
right.
that what we start doing?
That's a first step. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, was there any agreement from the master planning committee about how to expand the high school?
The master planning committee was split on the opinion of expanding either west or south. So that is why we were presented with both options, and the board selected or opted to take the west expansion because it just made more sense. So master planning never was unanimous. It never even had a majority of folks who wanted to go west versus south.
All right. Did the survey ask anything about maybe combining the 7th through 9th grades?
It did not. What makes you ask?
Oh, just curious whether or not that's an option.
Yeah, we, you know, because of the fact that 9th grade begins to be your college transcripts evaluation, there was a lot of communication from our faculty that indicated we really want to separate those grades where that is not high stakes performance from the years that are high stakes performance.
So also as part of grade realignment, we're going to need room for the all-day kindergarten. So that means that we need to find a place for our fifth graders so that those mm-hmm. classrooms can be used. Again, we're talking about maybe just planning for, I mean, we could use portable classrooms in at the elementary schools until we figure out what we're going to do with the fifth graders?
I don't know necessarily that that option is one that could work. Currently, our elementary schools, the lunch schedules run from about 10:30 till 1:30. Some of the schools, they can do 11 until 1:30. But we are not going to be able to squeeze in an additional grade in those support facilities. When you add students to a building, it's not just the classroom space. We've got, you know, staffing space. If we have our elementaries be K-6 or K-5, we're talking about adding administrative staff to each and every site. And so that, you know, we have to look at, is that the best use of our dollars? Because that all comes out of our M&O, you know, our main operating budget. So we are definitely open to any ideas or options, but definitely we have got a building that needs to be replaced, and we have 800 students that need to be housed.
So where are we going to put the fifth graders?
I don't know. Where do you think we should put them? That's what we're asking. Mm-hmm. Where do you think we should put them?
So is that the most important question to deal with then?
I think the most important questions are, what are the very best facilities that will house all 12 grades. And it has to be looked at from a holistic standpoint and not in a piecemeal manner. That was the direction and the action charge given to the Master Planning Committee. Now, unfortunately, we are looking at more onesies and twosies. We're looking at, okay, well, how do we solve this one problem? And
what's the impact on the other grades based on that? The Master Planning Committee was looking for a solution that was pre-K-12. The board felt and still feels that that was a viable plan, and it solved a lot of problems for us K-12. There were opinions about, well, maybe we should do this for this grade or this for that grade, but if you're not looking at it at a pre-K-12, yeah, you can pick a lot of pieces apart, but they all need to mesh together. So now what we're going to probably try to do is piecemeal as much as we can, but also try to not spend money on things that we're going to have to demolish or replace later when we have funding to do the building that needs to be done.
Well, that brings us back to Treasure Mountain Junior High School. We had heard during the bond campaign that it's going to cost us $1 million in Band-Aid repairs to keep the school operating. So what has to be done to ensure that the school can remain open, at least for the next few years?
Go ahead.
You know, our facilities manager, Todd Hansen, and our business administrator, Todd Hauber, they have a very elegant priorities-based capital planning approach. And so their direction is to spend as much as is absolutely necessary for the safety of our students and not a penny more. And so we will start reviewing those budgets in the first quarter and have a finalized budget by June. And then we'll know how much of that $1 million is required to be spent.
Well, we keep hearing that, you know, to protect the safety of our students. What is it that has to be done so that safety is ensured? I mean, is it replacing water lines? Is it an EPA question? I mean, we're talking about lead in the water. Are we talking about,
we are not.
Asbestos in the air?
There are definitely soils problems, and EPA is willing to address that on our behalf. What we're talking about in terms of safety of students are failing major systems in the building, plumbing, HVAC, roof structure. And so those are the things.
Fire alarm system. The fire alarm system has not been coordinated. They have not been able to coordinate the lights. And so we are in a situation where if those do go off, if someone has epilepsy or is prone to a seizure, the without the syncing of those lights, it could create a seizure. I mean, we're talking about the flow of the students in there. I mean, it is so crowded in there. That's the kind of safety things that we're talking about. We're talking about the water quality. And to repair those things, it is millions and millions of dollars. Currently, we're looking at probably just for next year, what we know needs to be fixed, about $500,000. And that is if a boiler doesn't blow up. And that is if the water system still functions in the piecemeal way we've got it. I mean, that is best case scenario.
What's the water quality issue, though?
There is a buildup in the pipes. There's a very large mineral buildup, and so it is not the best situation water-wise.
So you're either going to have to replace water pipes or put some kind of purification in there, or
maybe.
I mean, can you go in there and do what they call that pigging? You know, where
I think
it's kinda...
that gets done regularly. Exactly.
So does a bond come back on the ballot in November? Are you guys going to be able to manage that? Or, I mean, you still have to figure out how to build or not.
So, as you know, we have $19 million in the capital account. I am just one of five members. This is Nancy Garrison speaking. We are not in a position to bond this year. You know, from my perspective and from just returning from a statewide school boards association conference, those districts that were successful in passing bond this year made those decisions a year in advance of the election. So we've passed that sweet spot, in my opinion. And I'm just one of five.
Yeah. And this is Julie Eihausen speaking. I personally have absolutely no appetite to go out for bond.
So you're confident, though, that you're going to be able to go forward with grade realignment in another year?
We are. And I'm excited to talk about the SAGE results. So
because we keep hearing, you know, that we were one of the top in the state of Utah. But again, this is now national test. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about how we compare nationally, because that's really, you know, I mean, if we're 51st in terms of per pupil spending, I mean, are we really comparing ourselves against what needs to be compared?
Our governor was very impressed with our performance against national standards, given the investment, which is an interesting perspective. The details that we examined yesterday, Leslie, were our own in-state performance. So let me get back to you on the national comparisons, because I just quite simply haven't evaluated that and examined the data on the national side. We are, as perhaps you saw from the reports, we are number one in the state in terms of our English language arts performance. Interestingly, from my perspective, we are also number one in our English language learners performance, and yet their proficiency is at 7.4%.
Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, why is the ELL sector so far behind? Taxpayers have put millions of dollars into this effort for many, many years, and we're still not making headway on that achievement gap. Some would say that is the definition of insanity, to continue to do mm-hmm. the same thing over and over and have no change in results.
That is insanity, and that is why we have had a major overhaul in our reading English language arts program, which I'm happy to share some of those details with you, some major shifts in curriculum and instructional delivery. And I couldn't agree with you more. We are not meeting the growth standards that we expect for our English language learners, and we are putting a comprehensive plan in place to do that.
Do we know why, though, that we haven't met that? I mean, it's like you can say we're changing programs, but unless you know why it's not working, I mean, it's just, okay, well, we need a new program. Well, we need kindergarten aids.
Yes, in fact, we do know why. We know why with incredible specificity, and that is because we are using a system called Galileo that is matched to the standards that they are, in fact, tested on through SAGE, which is a nationwide evaluation related to the Utah Common Core. And so we can be very, very targeted with our instruction by looking at and drilling down on the Galileo data. It's an incredible tool that's been in the district for 2 full years now. We are starting our 3rd year. Our educators are really doing a phenomenal job learning more and more of the potential details that Galileo can share with them. Okay, well, is it this standard? What standard is the student struggling with? What is the best approach given this student's strengths and weaknesses? And that there is where the professional learning communities come in, and that is a research-based approach to instructional design that is very flexible and continually uses data, formative data and assessment, to redesign instruction.
Is the district up against any kind of penalties or anything? I mean, if in fact we don't meet this achievement gap issue?
The goal that we have, it's one of our main goals, is to close the achievement gap. And no, we're not really up against that again, because remember, we are number one in the state. Even though 7.4% is extremely low and unacceptable, we certainly are, it's not something that we want to toot our horn about, because it's not something to really be proud of, but we are number one in the state. So definitely closing that achievement gap is very, very important to us. And the exposure to earlier learning, that is one of the main reasons we are expanding the preschool and also implementing the all-day kindergarten, because the more we can front-load the education on these kids, the sooner we can get them caught up, the better it is for everyone.
And real quick, I just wanted to ask about that reading program, because, I mean, kind of the complaints in the community have to do with, well, you're getting rid of all of the teaching aids. What I'm understanding from the superintendent is that you've really just allocated that money and time to focus on the preschool and kindergarten grades.
That's where the staff will be utilized. Research, so we had some exposure to John Hattie's research, which is meta-analysis of 800 studies on English language arts and other performance indicators. That body of work clearly indicates that the professional learning communities and a shift to early childhood exposure to complex vocabulary is really where our English language learners are lacking. It's where the deficit starts early and continues. So the idea with and the research behind pre-K is that our youngest learners, and particularly our English language learners, get exposure by not being pulled out of a classroom where that complex academic language is being spoken, where they're being pushed up against their zone of proximal development, which is the ideal for growth. That is what we need to offer our kids. And when we take them out of the setting where that is going on, it's a detriment to them. And so we get to offer that to them in a compelling way. And that's research-based, it's change in instruction, and it's an increase, we expect an increase in performance as a result.
As soon as next year?
Oh, I sure hope so.
I hope so.
Okay, I need to leave it at that. Julie, okay. And Nancy, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
8:36, good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Council meets tomorrow, starting a work session at 4:15 in the studio. To preview the agenda, I have Assistant City Manager Matt Dias along with Economic Development Director Jonathan Weidenhammer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First up is the discussion on the Brew Pub Plaza. The design group heard a considerable amount from the City Council that basically said, let's keep this simple, Jonathan. At the top end, I saw a price tag for $10 million. That does not sound simple to me.
No, I think you're right. So we've had a number of discussions with the City Council, the last of which being on December 17th, where we heard just what you said, keep it simple. So our design team has created 3 concept designs, each of which was based on the smaller one before it. And so what we've done since that December meeting was to really create a skeleton or a nuts and bolts, you know, basic plaza design. It really just includes a flat event space, some restrooms, a little bit of storage, and a small stage. It kind of strips out a number of the amenities, a number of the features. And, you know, the balance of that is there's a number of goals that stakeholders and the community and people we interviewed over the past 3 and 4 months if we go with that stripped down scheme, we'll have to forego some of those amenities. Now, the biggest one that we're looking for some council input on Thursday is the parking end of it. You know, we're taking away about 49-50 parking spots by building this plaza, and the cost to replace those undergrounds about $3-3.5 million. And that's about $80,000 a stall, which is incredibly expensive. And so we want to talk to council a little bit about willingness to relocate that, potentially to the top of the existing China Bridge structure right behind your building here, potentially somewhere else in Old Town, or if they really want to see that replaced on site at that kind of price.
Yeah, and I'm just kind of curious, too, about the understanding. I mean, you know, creating another public plaza space, just drawing more people to an area where, I mean, the Historic Park City Alliance would say we're already 300 parking spots short just for the businesses and restaurants in town. Another maybe 50 spots gone. I mean, and then bringing even more people up here, that doesn't sound...
Well, yeah, ideal. I mean, this is the Historic Park City Alliance's kind of top prioritized project. We do want to bring people to Main Street, and we do want to make sure we spread them out around Main Street. So having an anchor or a magnet at the top is certainly a goal. We are at a bit of a crossroads with our environmental goals in terms of, are we going to bring a bunch more cars to the downtown from a traffic and congestion standpoint and from a carbon footprint standpoint? And I think this is the first time where we really get to try on and practice the conflict of those two goals. Yeah, I think, you know, as the economic guy, I think you're right. You know, we're short parking inventory in the downtown. And how we manage parking and how we manage employees and our, you know, the amount of supply we build or have and maintain, is these are really important questions.
So the discussion on Thursday will be what? I mean, how to scale it back and to reduce the costs, or?
Yeah, at the top of the food chain for the city is if we scale it back and you're willing to sacrifice goals of daily activity and having it be an anchor daily and the balance of a plaza that's only for events and is empty, you know, a number of days of the year versus do we want to keep some of those amenities that make it more of a public gathering area, you know, 24/7 or in the off seasons, or that, you know, the residents of the community or local business folks might come to during the rest of the time. That's part of the conversation. And again, how do we park it?
Yeah. And again, I mean, at one point we were talking about putting an ice rink there. The word is now is that the council would have to be convinced to do that.
Yeah, I think they were real clear with me that they don't understand why we'd build an ice rink, because it's really expensive and the cost to, you know, make it net zero from an energy efficiency standpoint ultimately comes out to be like $1.5 million. And so while our design team thinks that's, you know, if you look at the Gallivan Center, on a Monday night, it's filled with local folks. We think, you know, there'd be a good blend of tourists and people here 5 months out of the year that would come and recreate at it and use it. It's really expensive, and it's extra structure, and it's extra, you know, carbon footprint.
What's the timeline on this? I mean, do you hope to, like, get underway this spring, or?
You know, I've always held out hope that we could get the parking end of this built this summer and late fall. I think we're pretty convinced now we'll be starting in spring of 17.
Okay, but we still haven't decided how much parking to do.
Correct.
All right. This week and last on the consent agenda, we have been businesses that are going to be moving in during Sundance. Can we talk a little bit about some of these? I mean, these are not necessarily Sundance sponsors. I mean, we've got businesses like Sour Patch Kids, Perky Jerky, the Pet Cube Camera.
I can't speak in any great detail to any of them. Just, again, at a high level, the concept we have is... We have the Master Festival license and the Sundance official sponsors. They've all come in and been approved and regulated, and we've seen their site plans, and we know how to make those safe. A lot of the non-affiliated people that come in to do temporary licensing, we've made a really strong push over the past 2 years to try to get them in a process so that we know that they're safe and there's enough cops in town and enough public safety and parking and all those kind of things. However, they are a bit less organized than our relationship with Sundance, so they come in really late. So this is the way the city set up a push to get those people business licenses and get those places inspected.
Yeah. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be related to film, huh? I mean, we basically would just kind of allow anybody who wants to come in to come in?
Certainly. I mean, you know, you want to get a business license in Park City, you certainly have a right to do that, and we're obligated to facilitate and enable that to the degree it meets our codes and deadlines. And, you know, these aren't affiliated with the festival, but they're here to, you know, gain the rewards and of all the people in town. And we're here to make sure they can do that in a safe way.
All right. Also during work session, the council will be reviewing some municipal code amendments. Whatever happened with the recommendations from the special events committee? I mean, has that committee done anything that the council's even taken action on?
They haven't taken action yet, but this is the process by which you're going to start to see the results of that special event committee. That we call it the SEAC, Special Event Advisory. And again, that SEAC committee has community representatives from the schools, the resorts, lodging, Main Street. But we also have community members from different neighborhoods. And what they're trying to do is help us balance, you know, we haven't changed our special event codes as long as I've been here since 1999. And the world of events has changed dramatically in Park City. So what we're going through is a complete overhaul and update to our municipal code, to the way we regulate events and process events. And the SEAC committee has been instrumental in helping us get through that process in terms of this makes sense, this doesn't make sense. And another thing they're really helping us do and going to help council do is prioritize events. You know, we used to just kind of approve everything, and the only way we'd say no is if it was a public safety debacle. And now they're going to help us with a grading and scoring criteria that'll help balance economic return versus community impacts and try to find a better balance than we've had in the past.
So is that going to start this year?
It is going to start this year. So SEAC has met twice. I think their second meeting was last week. Their next meeting is coming up. They meet quarterly. And we're going to have council review the kind of final proposed changes to the event criteria, which make it easy for not-for-profits to be, you know, get an event through. We make sure we have our liability and insurance requirements tidied up. And, you know, we're also updating our fee waiver policy. What we found is as we've tightened up how we regulate events, the cost to provide public safety in particular and traffic regulation oversight in particular has got real cost to it that the city's just been assuming. So we've started to pass some of that on to our events, and they're struggling year over year with their budgets. And so we're getting our arms really around how we deal with fee waivers too.
And that's also on the agenda. We're talking about a three-year, $105,000 contract to pay for folks to basically direct traffic during Sundance. Why is that something that city taxpayers have to pick up?
Great question, because who's paying for that is we're using the parking revenue from the Sundance paid parking scheme to pay for that. And so 3 or 5 years ago, we started to put city volunteers at the intersection of Heber and Main to make sure the buses could get through and, you know, not hit any people. You know, as we've gotten a little expanded the circulation program in the downtown, we now have paid people that are at all the intersections to make sure that people can walk where they need to walk safely and buses and taxis aren't hitting them. It started to be a real cost, so we just needed to procure it formally. And again, the funding source for that is the paid parking revenue from the visitor during Sundance.
All right, and then back to this whole the SEAC committee. I mean, they're offering hall passes to events like Sundance and Kimball Arts Festival, or would they have to also go through this?
No, I mean, it's as we've gone through this process, you know, and worked out their role. It's only a couple meetings in, but they've already been kind of practicing and trying on these new codes to see how they'll pertain. And our biggest events certainly aren't immune from the recommendations and input of the SEAC committee. They've helped us and provided input already on, for example, the Kimball Arts Center as we've gone through their, you know, interim process and next steps.
Okay. Briefly, Matt, wanted to ask you, we've got also on the agenda a draft report on the water pollutant discharge. This is between Park City and the state of Utah, basically, to clean up what's coming out of our mine tunnels?
We do. This is an annual requirement as part of our stipulated order with the Environmental Protection Agency and the Division of Water Quality. So you'll see the municipality do this every year. It's also a wonderful opportunity for folks in our community to learn more about our water system and sort of the regulatory aspects of it and all the hard work that we do to treat the water coming out of the mines.
Yeah. Interesting, though, that this remains a draft report until 2033, and that's basically when Park City has to comply with what's been outlined.
That's true, and it does, at face value, that does sound sort of interesting, but it was a long and protracted negotiation, and through the hard work of city employees, we were able to negotiate a 20-year compliance period, And so this is meeting that, and that's been set in stone for several years now. So, you know, the community will see this every year, and the community should know that we negotiated a 20-year compliance period to work out with the regulators.
Do we need to see progress, though, each of those 20 years?
We will, in fact. And during years that we are undertaking a construction project, you'll see more regular updates. So in a year that we are actually undergoing construction or building perhaps a new facility, we'd be coming with quarterly or maybe biannual reports. So you'd be seeing more from us as the work increases.
So what are we talking about? What's how to reduce the antimony and arsenic?
All of the above, in fact, all of the above. You know, the water that that comes out of those mines needs to be treated. This jurisdiction, Park City Municipal, is responsible for both the judge and Spiro, and we're under that compliance order. And so, you know, we would be, over the next 20 years, working to bring that into compliance.
All right. Also on the agenda, an agreement with Salt Lake City to be able to use, for Park City to be able to use Spiro water year-round, not just for snowmaking anymore, huh?
Yeah, and these are sort of, actually, these are, you know, somewhat intertwined. I mean, since the jurisdiction is responsible or the responsible party for treating that water at its source where it's coming out of the mines, we want to have the most control over all the water coming out of there. And so this helps us do that.
So Salt Lake doesn't involved in cleaning it up since they are also an end user?
Well, they are involved, but since we're closest to the source and we have the facilities, you know, staff's been working on this for a long time. This original agreement about the share of water was created in 1991. So for several years, Clint McAfee, Tom Daly have been working with Salt Lake City. The time seemed right, and this is really just a one-year extension of that lease, but we are being able to pick up some additional water rights. And throughout time, that's never been looked upon, you know, negatively looking back. It's always something that you want to have control. We are the responsible party, and if we can control the majority of it, we'd like to.
Well, it sounds like we want to use it. I mean, it's not,
both. Right. But both. I mean, we're responsible for treating that water, so.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what are we going to use the water for? Just to, since we've got Judge off, we need more from Spiro, because we're able to remove the antimony due to the treatment plant there.
Great question. I think short-term.
Or the arsenic, excuse me.
Excuse me. Short-term, we're going to use it for snowmaking. That's kind of the short-term plan, but we are going to be working over the next year with Salt Lake City in terms of extending the agreement, and that could be variety uses. Highest and best use could be culinary, could be agrarian. There are a lot of different uses that the city might use that for.
All right. Real quick, and I don't know if you've gotten any information on it. We had just heard yesterday afternoon that the post office now charging everybody full $86 a year rental fee, and that's because basically they're telling their customers that the city won't allow them to deliver mail.
So I'm glad you asked me about that, and I've looked into it a little bit, and I haven't been able to find out much about it. We did contact the Postmaster General yesterday. It was news to her also. So I don't know if it's sort of the rumor mill going around or what's been happening. John next to me has a post office box in town, but I'm happy to we're looking into that. I'm going to try to find out some additional information for you. But we did contact the Postmaster General, and you know, her reaction was sort of like, I'm not sure that's not just a local rumor.
John, have you picked up your mail recently?
I haven't. We went through this a year or two ago, and we just simply told them, you know, we fought back, and they folded on us, so we'll see.
I had somebody call me and tell me that, he went to pick up, and there was the $86 bill. And it's like, well, the city, it lives in, you know, lower Woodside there, so it's...
Yeah, there was a conversation 2 or 3 years ago about putting up some gang boxes in the lower part of town by, you know, the library field. And so I think, again, I've been here 22 years, and 2 or 3 years ago was the first time they tried to make me pay again, and we said we live in Daly, and that's not going to happen. And they said, you're right, no problem.
Okay. Things may be changing, though. We'll follow up on it. One more thing?
Just one more thing. I wanted to let the community know in 2 weeks, on February 3rd at 8:30 in the morning, we have our annual Leadership 101. Miles Rademan, several staff members, and all sorts of people throughout our community, whether it's business or nonprofit, they get together and share information about our community, how people can get involved and what's going on. So February 3rd at 8:30 in the morning at the Marriott Conference Center. It's called Leadership 101, and we just love to have people attend.
All right.
Information's available on our website.
Matt Dias and Jonathan Weidenhaber, thanks. Well, the Youth Sports Alliance recently distributed grants and scholarships to local winter sports teams and athletes from funds earned at Jan's Winter Welcome. In the studio with me, I have Amy Preston, the director of the Youth Sports Alliance, along with Tom Eastwood. He's the co-chair of the Stein Erickson Youth Opportunity Endowment, along with one of the scholarship recipients, Leah Lang. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
So let's start with you, Amy. How much money did the JANS raise for you to distribute to your nine teams?
We grossed almost $500,000, and much of that has been distributed to the teams already. We do a grant process with them, and anything from safety equipment to helmets to luge sleds to a high-performance gym, and we were part of the Utah Olympic Park freestyle jumps in renovating that project over there for many of our teams to enjoy. And then we also have given out our first round of scholarships, over $30,000 in scholarships to 52 youth in our community, as well as 176 Get Out and Play kids. And that's what we want to talk about today, is Leah Lang is here, and she has been one of our scholarship recipients and has recently been offered a full ride scholarship to the University of Utah. And I have Tom Eastwood here, who is part of our Stein Erickson Endowment Committee and the future of how we're going to be able to fund these scholarships for kids.
So Leah was one of the recipients of the $30,000, one of the 52?
She was.
Yeah, so you had to apply for that, Leah?
Yeah, I did. Youth Sports Alliance has helped me out so much in making these ski competitions that I go to so much easier for my family.
Right, just, I mean, paying your travel expenses and coaches' fees and things like that?
Yeah, it makes a huge difference because the trips, with traveling so much, it adds up so quickly.
Yeah, so you are at the U now, or you're going to be attending the U?
Yeah, I'm going to start in the fall of 2016.
And you've been named to the team there?
Yep.
Congratulations. That's a big deal.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's usually Norwegians that...
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so what's your specialty?
Just cross-country skiing. I like classic over skate, but I still like skate a lot.
Mm-hmm. So even though she's off to college now and her things are paid for, it's just this...
Yeah, this is her final season, and mm-hmm. Her mother just told me that she made the world junior team, so I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that. I think you have an interview later, but that's a very big goal that she's been able to accomplish.
Yeah, just being able to, I'm so excited. That's the goal of the year, definitely, beyond the goals. So I'm really excited to go represent the U.S. ski team in Romania.
Okay, when does that happen?
I leave February 15th, and I'm gone for a month.
Wow, great. And again, money that YSA has helped.
Yeah, so our scholarships are financial need based, and we are able to help kids follow their dreams in sports that they have chosen. And we're also able to help those kids just in our Get Out and Play program to learn life lessons through sport in our 5-week introductory programs.
All right. So how does the Stein Erickson YSA Opportunity Endowment, Tom, help with all of this? Because we're just talking about money that was raised from JANS, right? JANS Winter Welcome?
Correct, yes.
Well, actually, yes. We launched the endowment in April of 2014, and our goal was to raise $2 million in 2 years, and we're at $1,750,000, so we're only about $250,000, $200,000 away. And we usually typically get about twice as many requests for scholarships as we were able to give from the JANS Winter Welcome. That's why we started the endowment. And Stein, it was kind of Stein's dream to put this endowment together and be associated kind of in giving him a legacy, and it was his dream to have a program that would allow kids to get out on the mountain to do the disciplines they wanted to do and be able to enjoy winter sports as he did as a child and as well during his career. Yeah. So,
have you seen some money come on with, because I know that was what his family had asked, rather than sending flowers and,
absolutely. We have received quite a number of contributions from after Stein's passing. It's been really great.
So basically, this is it's an endowment. It's mm-hmm. in a bank. You've got it being reinvested, and then
absolutely.
You're pulling the interest out of it each mm-hmm. year.
And that will be the idea, to just leave the principal in the account. And, of course, we'll grow the endowment, but we'll launch the endowment. The plan is to launch it in May of this year when we reach the $2 million, which was our goal. So then we'll start using it.
Yeah, so numbers guy, give us an idea of, I mean, how much money you might be able to pull out of that each year.
Well, we're looking for about somewhere between 80 and 100,000.
Wow, that'll help a lot.
We get requests typically for about $90,000 a year, and we're able to afford out of our Jan's Winter Welcome proceeds maybe 45. So this should be able to double our capabilities.
All right. People can still make those contributions. How?
Absolutely. And I'll turn that over to Amy because she knows all the...
So we have a website. It's at ysaparkcity.org. And there's a whole page dedicated to Stein and his endowment and the opportunity that he wanted to give to children in our community.
Okay. People can make donations online then as well?
They can. There's a donate button as big as you can see. Otherwise, you can call our office. We're at 435-214-0792.
Okay. And then, Leah, are we going to be able to follow you? Do you have a blog or website or a Facebook page or something people can follow you along?
Yeah, I do have a Facebook page, and I'll be posting days and updates while I'm in Europe racing.
Okay. Well, congratulations. That's a big deal.
Thank you.
Anything else you wanted to mention?
I would just say thank you to our community for helping us provide an opportunity to our local youth.
Okay. Amy,
absolutely.
Tom, and Leah,
absolutely.
Thanks.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time, now 8:59.
Morning Edition and Morning News with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you in part by Park City Medical Center, Jans Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, Promontory the Ranch Club and Promontory Foundation, and Carl Malone Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram.